Well,
if you look at the handle,
sure. Oh, she's just had a copy.
Well, thanks, Andy. You can look at the fasting. Everyone, welcome to this latest talk in the series of talks on the philosophy of nature and naturalism. Today we have Ray Brazier from the American University in Beirut, Lebanon, speaking to us, where he's Associate Professor of Philosophy and Head of Department. well known for this book in particular, Nile Unbound, Enlightenment and Extinction, and for a lot of original work around the concept of matter and the relation between philosophy and the natural sciences. And in particular, work, both translation and theoretical, on figures such as Badiou, Deleuze, Laruelle, Brandom, and Wilfred Sellers in particular in recent times. So, if nothing's changed, the title for today's talk is Nominalism, Naturalism, and Materialism.
Great. Okay, so this talk is part of the latest installment of kind of a long-running attempt to understand the way in which, Wilfred Sellers resolved some of the problems about the relationship between the normative order or conceptual order and natural order. So, although the talk will begin by examining Sellers' philosophy of language and the connection between his philosophy of language and his philosophy of mind, I hope ultimately to kind of, which may seem like a kind of a detour or something that's not immediately relevant to the philosophy of nature, I hope to kind of to steer it towards, to try to kind of explain how this is connected to his metaphysics. And Sellers is, a post-Kantian philosopher, a philosopher who kind of broadly accepts Kant's strictures on the possibility of metaphysics, and in particular his critique of dogmatic metaphysics, but nevertheless thinks that it's possible to still prosecute metaphysics despite despite the linguistic turn, etc. And in fact, the point of this paper is to show how even a philosopher who insists on the uncircumventability of the linguistic term can still generate a naturalistic metaphysics. Okay. I think this is significant and instructive because it diffuses or undermines what is taken to be a kind of canonical opposition between linguistic philosophy or philosophy informed by the linguistic turn as being something that is the exacerbation of the Kantian critique of metaphysics and something which ends up with what Meyer Sue has called correlationism, a philosophy that insists that all that philosophy can ever do, philosophy is just this kind of second order kind of critical reflective discourse. Sellers accepts this account of critical reflexivity, but still tries to show how it's embedded in this irreflexive ontological order. So this is what I'm going to try to kind of to explain. So nominalism, as traditionally understood, denies the existence of abstract entities, universals, forms, species, propositions, etc. Traditional nominalism proceeded from an empiricist epistemology that challenged the very possibility of metaphysics, whether idealist or materialist. And the critique of empiricism is taken to entail the refutation of nominalism. But nominalism contains a valuable insight for materialists. Reality does not have propositional form. And this is an insight that should be taken up by post-Darwinian materialists, or those who call themselves post-Darwinian naturalists, insofar as they ought to deny that reality has a conceptual structure. I'm not just identifying propositional structure with conceptual structure, but I think they are closely connected. And the nature of that connection will hopefully be elucidated in the closing stages of the paper. So for a consequent materialist, realism about abstract entities is problematic because it violates this nominalistic stricture and reiterates the theological presumption of a pre-established harmony between conceptual order and real order. So the question is whether materialism can take up this nominalistic insight while jettisoning the empiricist prejudices that tie it to skeptical relativism. For the claim that reality is devoid of propositional form need not require denying that we can capture aspects of reality in using propositional form, or that concepts have ontological purchase. So this is what I propose to investigate by considering the way in which Selgius combines a nominalist semantics, epistemic naturalism, and what I'm calling for the time being methodological as opposed to metaphysical materialism. And again, this is something I'm trying to kind of think through. So the nature of that contrast is still unclear in my own mind. So first I'll discuss Selgius' approach to ontology in connection with his nominalism. Then I'll try to explain how his nominalism feeds into his influential critique of the myth of the given. This will be followed by a brief explanation of Selgius' metalinguistic account of meaning. And then I will try to explain how this can be cashed out in terms of Selgius' materialist account of the relation between language and reality. Okay? So, first of all, the problem of ontology. By the way, most of the quotations, or most of the material that will be discussed in the paper is from a book called Naturalism and Ontology, which is four lectures that Sellers delivered in 1974, the John Dewey lectures that he delivered. I believe it was at the University of Chicago. I'm not sure about that. They were subsequently printed as a book. And it is one of the few places where Sellers connects all the components of his system in explicit form. And the term, so first of all, what are the requirements for a naturalistic ontology? Ontology is an attempt to answer the question, what is there? But this cannot be answered by listing names of entities, i.e. table, chair, tree, Moscow, Pushkin, Aeroflot. Table, chair, and tree are common nouns, i.e. names for types of objects. Moscow, Pushkin, Aeroflot are proper nouns, names for a particular object. Listing nouns, whether names of types or names of particulars, is uninformative because it offers us names without explaining what a name is or how it is related to its nominatum. And if ontology is to take the measure of Kant's critique of dogmatic metaphysics, it cannot remain content with conjuring yet another more or less arbitrary account of what there is. It has to explain how we know what there is. Now, one of the implications of epistemic finitude is that we do not know the divine names of things. Human names for things are not necessarily linked to the things they name. So the meaning of a name is not the designation of an essence. But nevertheless, there is a sense in which nomination can be construed, can be understood as lying at the basis of linguistic functioning. But only insofar as this nominative dimension does not pertain to meaning, but to material processes. So the names in which linguistic signification finds its ultimate aboutness do not signify. They are material patterns. So Selgius' solution to the problem of reference is at once dialectical and materialist. It ensures the autonomy of signification, of conceptual order, and it explains the link between signification and conceptual order, by grounding this in non-signifying patterns, non-signifying material patterns. So the task of a critical ontology is to explain what a name is, what a word is, and how it's related to something that is not a word. The three desiderata of a critical ontology are explaining what a name is and how it relates to what it names, why there is a difference between names and things, or words and objects. And lastly, what kinds of things there are, and indeed what a kind itself is. What kind of thing is a kind? So the answer to the question, what is there, also implies a response to the question, what is a category? Now, in its simplest version, the controversy over the status of categories is whether they are mind-independent attributes of one or several substances, or mind-dependent concepts, such as Kant's pure concepts of the understanding, or even something like Heidegger's existentials. Now, Sellers' suggestion is that they are neither. Categories are metalinguistic functions, but their metalinguistic function is nevertheless a mode of representing reality. The determination of categorical status depends on the identification of conceptual place or conceptual role. To specify an entity's category will be to determine certain logical semantic features of representation such that it is of that entity. Nevertheless, representation itself is not a conceptual relation or a relation between concepts and things. It is this account of the non-conceptual nature of representation that distinguishes Sellers from traditional accounts of representation construed as a relation between thoughts and things, and what renders his stance materialist in a methodological rather than strictly metaphysical sense. Because categories do not represent or designate any feature of the world, they are not phenomenologically intuitable. They cannot be read off the structure of language or of reality. And to assume otherwise, for Sellers, is to fall prey to what he famously called the myth of the given. Now, this myth has two forms, an epistemic form and a categorical form. The myth of the epistemic given is crystallized in the following inconsistent triad of premises generated by Christus. And actually, I should have put this on the handout. I'm sorry, this should have been the first thing on the handout, so because I realise that it's going to be a little bit... Actually, I might... Should I write it up on the board?
There's that paper over there.
Okay. It'll be helpful, otherwise it'll be just obscure. Very simple. Famous inconsistent triad at the heart of the myth of the epistemic. So that premise A is X, senses, read, sense, content, S, entails that X knows non-inferentially. Non-inferentially, that S is read. B is the ability to sense content is unacquired. And I'll just write the ability to sense is unacquired. And finally, C is the ability to know facts. Okay, so I'll write the ability to know facts of the form X is phi is acquired. I'm sorry, I'm going to say.
Yeah, this is a big deal.
I'll write C down again. Is the ability to know facts of the form X is phi is acquired. So this is the famous inconsistent triad. Okay. Now, classical empiricism is committed to this inconsistent triad, which is why it's internally incoherent. Okay. A and B together entail not C. B and C together entail not A. And A and C together entail not B. In other words, it's impossible to hold all three to embrace all three premises at once. Knowledge is a fact. To know something is to know that such and such is the case. Facts are propositional form, X is phi. Either the ability to know facts of the form X is phi is acquired, or it is unacquired. If it is acquired, then it cannot be a sensory capacity, since, by hypothesis, the ability to sense content is unacquired. So, the ability to know facts must be unacquired. But if it is unacquired, then the world must have propositional form. And this propositional form is mirrored directly by the mind. Since propositional form is tantamount to intelligible order, one must either invoke God to account for the isomorphy between the structure of the world and the structure of the mind, or leave it unexplained. Okay, this is kind of a brief digest of Sellars' arguments. Okay? So Sellars argues that premise A is false, i.e. the claim X, premise A being X senses red sense content S, entails that X knows non-inferentially that S is red. He thinks that B and C, he accepts B and C. He thinks it's true that the ability to sense content is unacquired. It's just part of our kind of biological legacy. He also thinks that it's true that the ability to know facts of the form X is phi is acquired. In other words, the ability to recognize that something is thus and so requires, some elementary conceptual abilities. So, according to Sellars, if A is false because sensing a red sense content S does not entail knowing non-inferentially that S is red. Sensory awareness alone does not constitute knowledge. The non-inferential knowledge that X is phi, such as seeing that blood is red or hearing that the clock has struck 12, is a conceptually mediated perception and not a sensible intuition. The perceptual immediacy of such knowledge is mediated by an elaborate conceptual framework of objects related in a publicly observable space and time. Now, the key thing to understand is that sensory awareness is not awareness as. Okay. To be aware of an item having categorical status F is not to be aware of it as F. I mean, the example, you can train rats to recognize triangles on a board. They can be aware of F, but they're not aware of these triangles as triangles. This is a crucial distinction. So to sense something as S is to deploy the concept of S, to recognize S as S. And this deployment, in Sellars' account, must be rule-governed. But rule-following is thinking, which is an activity irreducible to sensing. In its most elementary form, the myth of the epistemic given consists in conflating thinking with sensing, or in Kantian parlance, concepts with intuition. Thinking cannot touch the real. It belongs to a different order. But as we shall see, this does not oblige us to deny that we can successfully think about the real or deny that thinking is necessarily embedded within reality. So in other words, the myth of the given, in its simplest form, is simply the claim that you can touch the real through thought, that thinking grasps the real. And Sellars wants to deny this, by distinguishing between the conceptual order and the sensible order, and show that our sensible constitution embeds us in the real order, or embeds us in the natural order, but our conceptual capacities separate us from it, or distance us from it. So the problem is explaining how concepts have traction upon the real without there being any kind of congruence or contact between concepts and objects. So sensation is of the real but cannot be about it. Thinking is about the real but cannot enter into direct contact with it. Failure to distinguish between thinking and sensing leads straight to the second version of the myth of the categorical given, according to which the categorical structure of reality, assuming it has one, impresses itself upon the mind in the way a seal impresses itself upon wax. Sellars argues that this cannot be the case because thinking depends upon language and the structure of language does not simply reflect the structure of reality. But before we say something about how we ought to understand thinking once we have abandoned the myth of the given, we must explain why rejecting the myth does not entail skepticism. It is important to see that skepticism binds into the myth of the epistemic given. Skepticism must assume that appearances are given with determinate conceptual characteristics, even as it questions whether there can be any correspondence between the structure of appearance and the structure of reality. So skepticism, on this account, unwittingly presupposes knowledge of appearance, even as it presumes to cast doubts upon their connection to reality. Moreover, it cannot explain why there are appearances, for it cannot claim that appearances are mere appearances on pain of a problematic regress. What are the appearances of? But to assume that determinately structured appearances are given is already to assume too much. Once the myth of the epistemic given has been dispelled, it becomes necessary to admit that sensing as already presupposes knowledge of a structured domain of objects existing in a framework of space and time. Now, it may sound platitudinous to repeat once again or to hear once more that the mind is not a private inner sanctum, that it is externalized in the world, and that this externalization is a consequence of its connection to linguistic activity. And in endorsing this basic thesis, Sellars shares Heidegger and Wittgenstein's rejection of the Cartesian privacy, the alleged Cartesian privacy of the mental. But unlike both of them, he situates this insight within a broader metaphysical account of the place of mind in nature. That thinking and language use are both essential activities will turn out to be crucial to this account, that they're forms of doing. Thinking and talking, or using language, are forms of practice. And this practical aspect of both thinking and speaking feed into, it will turn out to be kind of decisive for understanding Sellars' commitment to a process ontology, an account that nature essentially consists of processes, not objects. So the concept, once we've abandoned the myth of the given, the game, the claim that we can simply kind of grasp our own thoughts through some kind of immediate preconceptual contact, the concept of inner thought episodes must be understood to be modeled on publicly observable sayings out loud. This is a direct consequence of rejecting the myth of the epistemic given. So the ability to apperceive our own mental states is acquired and not innate. Introspection is a corollary of retrospection. The ability to introspect and perceive that one is thinking X or that one is feeling Y presupposes conceptual capacities rooted in linguistic practice. Okay. But this is not contrary to, again, to a kind of what some philosophers who dismiss this as a kind of an antiquated kind of philosophical behaviorism. To say this is not to say that thinking is reducible to verbal behavior or to dispositions to behave verbally. The claim that speaking is prior to thinking in the order of knowing is compatible with the claim that thinking is prior to speaking in the order of being. Pre- or non-verbal thought is perfectly real. But our ability to apperceive ourselves thinking is nevertheless linguistically mediated. So Sellars is as much of a realist about what he calls inner thought episodes as Descartes was. His amendment to Cartesianism insists only that access to inner reality is just as mediated as access to so-called outer reality. So he does not say that our thoughts are necessarily public or even essentially publicizable. His claim, rather, is that our ability to understand what a thought is, or what it is to have a thought, is tributary to communally generated and publicly shared conceptual resources. And by the same token, Sellars' realism about internal thought episodes does not commit him to the Cartesian claim that covert thought stands to overt speech as cause to effect. The claim that thinking is essentially related to the capacity for linguistic expression does not identify thinking with linguistic behavior. Rather, it postulates that the former is constitutive of the latter, in the same sense in which molecules are constitutive of gases. Thoughts are in language-using animals in the same sense in which molecules are in gases. But it is just as mistaken to construe thoughts as the cause of linguistic behavior as to construe molecules as the cause of gas volume. The connection is one of constitution, not causation. Thus, it is part of the definition of the occurrentness of thought acts, the occurrentness is the actuality of thought acts, which is the ontological status of, the ontological reality of thought, requires that they be expressible in what Sellers calls sayings out loud, even if no saying occurs. Okay. Now, finally, before I go on to explain how this relates to Sellers' philosophy of language. Empiricism and Cartesianism are not the only tributaries of this myth. Phenomenology is too. Our understanding of thought is not just modeled on our understanding of language. The intentionality of thought, according to Sellers, derives from the intentionality of discourse. Intentionality is not a psychological or phenomenological property. It's a metalinguistic characteristic. Thought is not the locus of an originary intentionality that is subsequently transmitted to language. Intentionality is primarily a property of candid public speech established via the development of metalinguistic resources that allow us to talk about talk. And this rejection of the postulate of an originary or transcendental intentionality is another direct consequence of abandoning the myth of the given. Again, it's important to underline this because some phenomenologists think they have nothing to learn from Sellers because he's just criticizing a kind of, you know, sense datum empiricism or some kind of naive Cartesianism, and that they, you know, they're way beyond that anyway. He's actually the most, you know, acute, I think, critic of the pretensions of phenomenology. Certainly the pretensions of transcendental phenomenology in 20th century philosophy. Because, you know, Sellers' project is a systematic dismantling of the claim that phenomenology could ever be first philosophy. It could still be categorical analysis on his accounts. He's not demolishing every version of phenomenology, but phenomenology then would have to abandon its claims about the primacy of intentionality or the alleged transcendental status of intentionality. So if intentionality is primarily a linguistic phenomenon, what does this imply for our understanding of meaning, not only as it pertains to mind, but also as it pertains to nature? Okay, so now we come to Sellers' metalinguistic nominalism. So semantic statements such as rouge in French means red. This is now, if you look at the first section on the handout, you've got the gist of the account. This is a semantic statement. It's a statement that rouge in French means red in English. Kind of primitive semantic statement. According to Sellers, what's really going on in these statements must be understood at the metalinguistic level. So the statement rouge in French means red in English quotes a sign design in one language, rouge in French, because you can the point about a semantic statement is that you're trying to explain what this sound design in a foreign language means to someone who in their own familiar language. Okay? If you need to say this, you're saying it to someone who doesn't know what rouge means. Okay? So therefore you're quoting the sign design rouge, and you're correlating it with the function it has in our own language, or in the speaker's native language. Okay. More generally, semantic operators such as means, designate, refers, or stands for correlate the functioning of unfamiliar words with the functioning of familiar words. So the means in a semantic statement, such as rouge means red, is a special version of the copula, according to Sperry. It's just a stand-in for is. Rouge is red. It establishes a correlation between a distributive singular term and what Sellers calls a metalinguistic sortal. Okay, so the So in a statement such as so if you go on the handout, first thing is that when you the foreign word or the word whose meaning is not available to the speaker is mentioned, but mentioned in a peculiar way. Red, the familiar word, when you say rouge means red, you're using the word red in a special way, not as it is ordinarily used in English, i.e. as meaning the color red, but as an illustrating sortal in a metalinguistic assertion. You're pointing to the function that the word red plays in your language. So, in statements such as "a rouge" in French is a dot quote red, or "a triangulaire" is a dot quote triangular, rouge and triangulaire both function as distributive singular terms rather than abstract nouns. And because of this, it's preferable to mark this by pluralizing them. Rouge in French, or dot quote red in English, or triangulaires in French, or dot quote triangulars in English. The pluralization shows that these indicate particular linguistic tokenings rather than the name of an abstract linguistic type. Were this not the case, we would simply be substituting reference to abstract linguistic entities for reference to abstract extra-linguistic entities. So in order for the strategy to work, it is necessary to insist that only particular linguistic tokenings exist, not linguistic types. So in other words, the function in English of red, the sign design red, has to be understood in terms of individual, particular tokenings of this sign design, not to the type. And this is crucial, because otherwise you're not engaging in a nominalistic strategy at all. You're just substituting one kind of abstract entity for another, a linguistic abstraction for an allegedly kind of non-linguistic abstraction. So this is what is shown by correlating the distributive singular terms rouge and triangulaire with the metalinguistic sortals dot quote red and dot quote triangular. The pluralization is outside the dot quotes because you're pointing to individual or particular tokenings of this sign design. And what you're saying is that there is no more to the linguistic functioning of this word, this sign design, than its utterance or inscription by individual speakers or particular places and times. That's the force of the reduction. Okay. So secondly, but by the way, the word sortal, I mean, I'm sorry if this is odd, the word sortal just means like a sort of thing. Like if you, a sortal is, you count the types of things. Okay. A lion, donkey, table, window are sortals because it refers to kind of any entity that you can classify and count the instances of in a statement or thought. Okay. So the claim is that these, a dot-quoted term shows a metalinguistic sortal. Okay, it's metalinguistic because it's showing how a sign design, the sort of sign design in an object language. Now this metalinguistic strategy can also be used to explain why abstract singular terms should not be taken as designating abstract entities. Thus consider the abstract singular term redness. Sellers insists it is a mistake to treat it as the name of an abstract entity. The meaning of statements involving redness can be reformulated without loss using the predicate red. So A exemplifies redness is equivalent to A is red. To claim that it isn't is to claim that the context exemplifies redness means something other than the context is red. Okay. But to say this is to insist that exemplification is also the name of an abstract entity, the so-called exemplification nexus through which an object A is supposed to be connected to redness. And it's important to see that to append this metaphysical annex to ordinary usage is to invite a regress. For if we insist on explaining the meaning of relational expressions in terms of designation, we will always require another abstract relational term to explain the relation between the particular, the universal, and their relation. This is just a version of the third man argument. Now the next passage, Serres wants to insist that abstract singular terms can be dispensed with, and they can be explained in terms of metalinguistic functioning. Okay. And now the next quote on the handout is actually a quote from Serres himself, okay, in which he tries to specify the peculiar, what is characteristic about his nominalism. And so this is Serres writing in a paper called Mental Events, written in 1978. It's actually published in 1981. In general, the nominalist holds that there is no such thing which red stands for because it stands for red things, and red things is not a thing. Now, it is a truism that the concatenation of red with A tells us that A is red. But is this fact illuminated by the idea that A is correlated with A? And the italicized A just means the object A, as opposed to the name A. And that red is correlated with red things? I think not. To understand what is going on, we need a different perspective on the syntactical form of red A. I submit that it is properly viewed not as a concatenation of two referring expressions, but rather as a name, A, which has the character of being concatenated to the left with a case of the sign design, red. And the Francis Baucus, I mean, the empty... the empty voice, that was the expression that nominalists used to characterize the names of universals, that they shouldn't be taken to be designating abstract entities. So if we abbreviate the expression concatenated to the left with a red by the expression red asterisk, we can say with respect to a token T of the expression red A, that while superficially T is a red, that square should actually be, it's just to show that the two symbols, the symbol red is concatenated with the symbol A. The square should be this mark. You're just linking, concatenating the sign design. Okay. So while superficially T is red concatenated with an A, i.e. red concatenated with an A, its true form, its depth parameter, so to speak, is given by T is A concatenated to the left with a red. Okay? The A is what you substitute for the expression, so that T is a red A. T is an A concatenated to the left with a red. This is a metalinguistic assertion, because what you're talking about here is the name A and the sign design red. Okay? The point that Serres is trying to make here is that he's trying to establish a relationship between what he calls let's call them real properties, redness. Redness is a real property that exists in spatial temporal reality. Okay? linguistic property, given that abstract singular terms do not designate or do not refer. So what he's saying here is that the property concatenated to the left with array, this is a metalinguistic property, okay. This is the counterpart property for what we would call a real property, redness. Okay. And the crucial claim that Serres is going to make is that these counterpart properties, such as, you know, counterpart properties such as concatenated left with a red, picture real properties. They represent real properties, but they represent real properties non-conceptually. Okay. So this is what I want to try to explain. So fundamentally, Serres insists that the part played by relational expressions and empirical predicates in linguistic statements can be reconstructed without hypostatizing them as abstract entities. And his chief inspiration here is Wittgenstein's claim in the Tractatus that we say that A is related to B by placing the names A and B in a certain dyadic relation. This dyadic relation is a pattern of inscription, and it is the inscription that shows how A and B are related by inserting the symbol R between the names A and B. But the relation itself is not an object. This is crucial. And the token R, you know, the sign token R that relates the sign tokens A and B is not a name. Thus, what the sign token R does in the statement ARB could be done without using a symbol. So consider now the statement A is larger than B. Okay, so here this is the next section on the handout. The first proposition is ARB. So ARB says that A is related to B. Okay, let's say the relation in question is being larger than. We you know, ordinarily express this as A is larger than B. We could adopt a convention whereby the graphic properties of the inscriptions A and B say what the statement A is larger than B says. For example, by writing the A above the B, in, such as in example 3. You simply show that A is larger than B, okay, by writing these sign designs in this way, by writing the A on top of the B. And this says exactly what A is larger than B says in our more, you know, conventional linguistic usage. This inscription states what A is larger than B states, but it does so without using the expression is larger than. Now, it is crucial for sellers of accounts to note that nothing in example 3, okay, in this inscription, plays the role allegedly played by the expression is larger than. Okay. That the B is below the A is essential to the meaning of this statement, okay, because this inscription means that A is larger than B. But this feature does not correspond to the role played by the expression is larger than. Rather, in the inscription, in inscription number 3, B being below A plays the role played by A and B having the inscription is larger than between them. So, both the inscription is larger than and the inscription B being below A are functioning here as inscriptions, which is to say graphic objects, rather than signifying expressions. Okay? They are objects, not expressions, not linguistic expressions. Similarly, the statement X is red, which means that object X has the property red, could be simply written by bold-faced X, as an example four. Number four means X is red. Okay. These examples, so Sellers wants to develop this account of the dispensability of predicates through, by constructing this, a language which he called jumblies. Okay. And jumblies is a language without predicates, in which it's a language that consists solely of names, but the ways in which the names are inscribed plays the role played by predicative expressions in more familiar languages. Okay. So number four is a jumblies expression. It's jumblies for X is red. It has two. Here it is the way in which the name X is inscribed that tells us what property the object X has. So the inscription X has two relevant features. It features a token of the name X, which refers to an object X, and it has a specific graphic characteristic. And fundamentally, Sellers' claim is that predicates do not play an independent role within linguistic expressions. This is a quote. Not only are predicative expressions dispensable, the very function played by predicates is dispensable. He's careful to specify that this dispensability claim applies only to empirical predicates. In other words, predicates that pertain to empirical reality, in some broad sense. So it's a mistake, what falls from this account, it's a mistake to abstract the role played by predicates from the role of the expressions in which they occur. He wants to emphasize the primacy of sentential structure. Predicates can only operate properly within a sentential form. And it is this abstraction of a fragment of function that encourages the mistaken idea that predicates designate conceptual properties or metaphysical attributes. The predicative role should not be reified and turned into an abstract entity called a property. And even the word property is a kind of another metalinguistic sort, okay, which exists independently of sentential context. Still less should the conceptual property supposedly expressed by the predicate be hypostatized and turned into an ontological attribute that exists not only independently of language, as conceptual properties are alleged to, but independently of thought. So as Sellers puts it, quote, the extra linguistic domain consists of objects, not facts. To put it bluntly, propositional form belongs only in the linguistic and conceptual orders. Now, what Sellers means by an object here is, you know, kind of, he hasn't yet told us what he means by an object, but it will turn out that he is precisely not committed to an ontology. The point being is that we don't yet know what types of objects there are. Okay. And it may be that even the category of object has to be dispensed with. And in fact, this is where his account is leading. It's an attempt to distinguish between what he calls object-bound and absolute varieties of physical process. But we must explain, we haven't yet gotten to this stage. Okay? Now the point in this discussion is that in the final analysis, conceptual functions are linguistically incarnated in sign designs whose material characteristics, according to Sellers, represent, or the term he actually uses is picture objects. So, semantic functions are nothing independently of this incarnation. But picturing itself is not a semantic relation or function. Picturing, in Sellers' account, is a ubiquitous natural phenomenon. Objects picture other objects. A CD pictures a piece of music, via complex transcoding of information from one physical medium into another. Sellers describes this as a second-order isomorphism between objects in the natural order. Picturing is a relationship between objects. What Sellers is actually doing is that he's revising Wittgenstein's Tractatus account of picturing. According to Wittgenstein and the Tractatus, it is facts that picture other facts. Linguistic facts picture non-linguistic facts. Sellers wants to think that this is a mistake because a fact by definition has propositional form. A fact is the statement that such and such a state of affairs obtains. Okay? And that the claim is he wants to explain picturing at the level of relations between what he calls natural linguistic objects or words considered as items or objects in the natural order as related to other objects in the natural order. A methodological point here. What is important here is that two things. One is the relationship between the manifest and the scientific image. Okay, when we talk about the graphic properties or the perceptible properties of inscriptions or vocalizations that allow them to picture non-linguistic objects. Now, to do this, we are pointing out to properties that are within the manifest image. This is what I'm really trying to argue for is that the claim, the indispensability of the manifest image in Szilárdi metaphysics. Okay? The claim, the critique of the myth of the given implies that the manifest image is a collective cognitive achievement. It's an indispensable cognitive achievement. Okay? And the manifest image allows us to recognize objects, middle-sized physical objects, with various perceptible property. Okay. Sign designs, vocalizations, inscriptions are manifest physical objects. Okay. And the properties they have, the graphic properties of inscriptions or the acoustic properties of vocalizations are perceptible manifest properties. What Sellers is trying to show is how you can use the manifest image as a leverage point to get to what he calls the scientific, the underlying scientific or the underlying noumenal reality, so to speak. And this is why I call it a methodological materialism, because the claim is that we construct our understanding of the physical order, the kind of the basic characteristics of the physical order, first of all, using the resources of the manifest image. The manifest image gives us a rudimentary account of what it means for something to exist in the physical object, in the physical order. It must have certain perceptible properties. We can use these properties. These properties are actually indispensable in explaining how processes, signifying processes unfolding within the perceptual order, lock on to imperceptible noumenal processes. And this is what I think is peculiar about, this is why I want to call Sellers' materialism methodological. The point is that Sellers is not simply saying, he's neither simply kind of deferring to the ultimate authority of the scientific image, nor is he, kind of appealing to some kind of, intuition about what the ultimate nature of matter is. He's showing how the perceptual order and the range of physical properties available to us within the perceptual order is what anchors our conceptual practices to the extra-conceptual order. Okay. So, this is why Sellars' rejection of the myth of the given does not lead to linguistic idealism and the claim that reality is a linguistic construct, but rather to the claim that language is embedded in non-linguistic, asignifying reality. A reality devoid of propositional form and hence of conceptual structure. Thus, Sellars' nominalism is part and parcel of his embrace of naturalism as well as of materialism, and these are not equivalent. He is a naturalist because he claims that linguistic practice, in which thinking is rooted, is a variety of natural process. Okay. Natural science investigates these processes. That linguistic activity is a distinct and possibly even a unique variety of natural process, whose specificity should not be elided, is part of Sellars' Kantianism. But in addition, Sellars is a materialist because of his insistence that the varieties of natural process extend well beyond those comprehended within the organic realm. To be a materialist is to refuse to organicize nature, i.e. to use the organism as an explanatory paradigm for the whole of reality. So what makes Sellars a materialist, but you know, I'd like to suggest a non-metaphysical materialist, is his insistence that linguistic function is ultimately rooted in inorganic as well as organic patterns. Sounds mark spacing movements. In other words, because Sellars is a pragmatist, so he insists that thinking is a kind of doing, it's something that organisms do. But the key thing is that the properties that tie our conceptual practices to extra-conceptual reality are not organic properties. They are material properties, they are inorganic properties. Spatial, graphic, etc., etc. So these are what Sellars, these sounds, marks, spacings, movements, these are what Sellars calls natural linguistic objects. And natural linguistic objects are names that depict part of reality. Names are part of the natural order, but only insofar as they are meaningless. This is why reference is not a semantic relation. So representation on this account, which is what picturing is not an epistemic relation but a natural function. And a general theory of representational systems will distinguish between sensate and insensate varieties of representational function. Animal representational systems, according to Sellars, operate through propositional form, which has both a referring and a characterizing aspect. The point at which, so Sellars wants to say that linguistic functioning, or what he calls signification, bottoms out in representation, and representation is a picturing relation between natural linguistic objects and other objects. This picturing relation is incarnated in the brain, the cortex, and central nervous systems of organisms. Okay. But what he wants to say is that this this kind of elementary stratum of representation is the point at which propositional form can provide a substratum for conceptual form. And this is crucial, is that he thinks there's three things that have to be distinguished here. There's propositional form. Propositional form is simply, has a characterizing, has a referring and a characterizing aspect. Okay? The representation of an object, A, is being read, is carried out by the characterizing inscription of a symbol token, A. If you think about, the claim is that inscription number 4, this representation that A is read, can be incarnated in the central nervous system of a pre-linguistic animal. So it's important to understand that propositional form in this particular sense is more fundamental than either logical or conceptual form. It is exemplified by expressions of the sort, this red triangle, which is not a sentence. But the claim is that these elementary propositions can be instantiated in the nervous systems of non-linguistic animals. And this is important because there has to be a point of there has to be a point where the conceptual order and the real order interlock.